Chapter 10. Does home plate look like a dinner plate? Chris wrote a letter to Mr. Steinbrenner in October 1980. He expressed his thanks to the boss for all of the support that he and the Yankees had given to our family over the years, especially during the trial. I knew that my son was writing to George. What I didn't know was that it included a special request in the letter. The boys had heard the story of my accident thousands of times. They had also heard how their grandmother, along with the Giants, Dodgers, and Yankees, helped to pull me out of my deep depression. Chris remembered me saying that my dream as a boy was to throw out the first pitch in an important game. He wanted that dream to come true. In his letter, Chris asked Mr. Steinbrenner to think of me when he was making selections for a ceremonial first pitch honors at Yankee Stadium. George sent a very nice reply, promising to put me on the list when the Yankees reached the World Series. They missed out in 1980, but did return to the Fall Classic the following season. The Yankees would be playing their old rival, the Dodgers, in the 1981 World Series. It would be their third championship matchup with Los Angeles in 5 years. A few days before the series began, George's PR director called me. I had made the list. The plan that Mr. Steinbrenner laid out was for Hollywood legend Jimmy Cagney to throw out the pitch before the first game. Cagney's most famous role was as George M. Cohen in the classic 1941 film Yankee Doodle Dandy. He won an Academy Award for the part. The guy was a living legend, a New Yorker through and through, and a true Yankee. The second game was to feature Mr. Rizzuto, who had been the 1951 World Series MVP, versus the Dodgers. I would be throwing out the pitch alongside him to honor the 30-year anniversary of his MVP award and the unique friendship that we developed starting that year. The Yankees would then go on the road to Dodger Stadium for games 3, 4, and 5. Game 6 honors would go to Joe DiMaggio, who was celebrating the 40th anniversary of his 56-game hitting streak. Game 7 ceremonial pitch would be handled by Don Larsen. 25 years earlier, Larsen pitched the only perfect game in World Series history. That also happened against the Dodgers. I was excited. Chris was even more thrilled. One of my childhood dreams was to come true in front of millions, thanks to my son. Then the commissioner stepped in to alter the plans. Bowie Kuhn, baseball's head honcho, gave an order that no celebrities or politicians were allowed to throw out World Series first pitches. It had to be someone connected to baseball. I made the cut, but Jimmy Cagney did not. George was forced to rescind the invitation to the silver screen icon. After a mad scramble, Joe DiMaggio agreed to move up his appearance to Game 1. There was immediate outrage from Jimmy Cagney fans throughout the world. How could he be humiliated like that? To prevent an international black eye for baseball, Commissioner Kuhn reversed the order. Good news for Cagney, bad news for me. Rizzuto and I were bumped from Game 2 so that the Oscar-winning actor would throw out the first pitch without having to wait another week. Don Larsen moved his game up from 7 to 6. Scooter and I were then rescheduled to throw out the first pitch at Game 7. Sadly, that game never happened. The Yankees lost to the Dodgers in 6, giving L.A. the championship. I saw Mr. Steinbrenner after the game. His team had just been defeated, but all he was worried about was that my feelings would be hurt. George apologized profusely and asked me to say sorry to Chris for him. I appreciated that. He told me that I'd be at the top of the list the next time the Yankees got to the World Series. They didn't return for another 15 years. George also asked what charities I supported. I named a few, like the Seeing Eye and Holy Family. Over the years, he quietly sent large checks to all of them. That was the type of man George Steinbrenner was. He was a kind soul. He never hesitated to help those in need or to donate to good causes. I deeply admired him for that, and I tried to emulate his philanthropic spirit. Shortly after that, Holy Family hired a new administrator. I kept in touch with Sister Anthony Marie and the nuns who shaped my life. But times were changing by the early 1980s. Most school districts were assimilating blind students which was amazing progress. It spelled doom for schools like Holy Family, which were dedicated solely to helping the blind. In an effort to keep afloat, the nuns welcomed students with other major disabilities. The increased workload was proving too much for the sisters to handle, so they turned to lay teachers and administrators. Herb Miller was a born leader. As soon as he took the job as administrator at Holy Family, he put into motion a plan for the school that went beyond the walls of the building. He became a passionate advocate for the blind. Herb and his wife, Zinnia, loved the students as if they were their own children. Herb wasn't shy about mingling with politicians and business people to gain needed support for the school and to help create new laws making life easier for the disabled. He was already doing that on a local level, but wanted to broaden his horizons. He reached out to me for help. Other than the occasional fundraising drive and speeches to Lions clubs around New Jersey, I hadn't done much directly for my alma mater. Herb asked if I would give him a hand in promoting the school and his mission. I leaped at the chance. I wasn't officially an employee of Holy Family, but I became Herb's teammate. It was the start of a productive partnership. My list of guys was pretty long. I had no shortage of volunteers to take me to games. Even so, Herb became my most frequent companion, followed closely by Gene Meal and Bob Deal. The Yankees of the 1980s were a fun group, though a little tamer than the Bronx Zoo 1970s crew. Sparky, Reggie, and Goose were gone by then. There were a few holdovers. Willie Randolph, Ron Guidry, and Greg Nettles were among the last links to the championship teams. All three would be named Yankee captains. Two young guys, first baseman Don Mattingly and pitcher Dave Grigetti, made an immediate impact and became close friends. Mattingly started joking with me almost from the day that he arrived. He would tease me about everything from my escorts and wardrobe to the size of the microphones and recorders I used. I played right along with him, and even pulled some pranks of my own. I was standing with Herb Miller at Yankee outfielder Dave Winfield's locker, interviewing the future Hall of Famer about an upcoming series with the Detroit Tigers, when Charlie, the clubhouse guard, came over to say, "You have about 10 minutes left before I have to close the locker room, Eddie." I checked my watch and said, "Got it, Charlie. I'll leave in 10. Mattingly happened to see me check the watch, missing the part where I flipped up the glass to feel the braille. He was astonished. Racing over from his locker, Don said, "Eddie, how the heck can you tell time with a wristwatch? You can't see that thing. It probably doesn't even work. Come on, you probably just wear it for show." I took the watch off and handed it to him so that he could see that it was functioning like any other timepiece. This frustrated Mattingly to no end. He could see the braille on the inside of the glass, but didn't realize that there was a secret button to push to flip the glass up. He spent the next 3 minutes feeling the face of the watch again and again, as several players looked on with curiosity. Finally, he gave up. Mattingly handed the watch back to me and said, "Eddie, I don't know how you do it, pal. You can feel those bumps through the glass, and I can't. That's amazing." "Well, Don," I replied with a grin, "some guys can hit curveballs. Some can't. Some guys can feel braille through the glass. Some can't. We've both got our talents." As Herb walked me toward the door and away from Mattingly, I turned to him and called out, "Hey, Don!" As soon as I had his attention, I held my wrist up, pushed the button, and revealed the secret of the watch. Other players roared with laughter. I had to run out the door to avoid the barrage of towels the freshly pranked Mattingly good-naturedly tossed in my direction. Dave Grigetti, like Ted Williams and several other players, loved seeing my dog. I would bring Flo with me whenever I could. Dave always took time to pet her. Flo was very well behaved in the clubhouse. One afternoon, she started jumping around and barking. This was totally uncharacteristic. It went completely against her training. I couldn't figure out what was spooking her until a few days later when Greg Nettles shared with me that he brought a sonic dog whistle into the locker room and was blowing it to see what Flo would do. Only she could hear it. Players were actually pranking my dog. I don't think any other media members could say that. By the end of 1981, Flo began slowing down to the point where she had to retire. Once again, I was heartbroken, but knew that she would be happier on the farm. Another 3-week trip to the Seeing Eye brought me together with my third dog, Bessie. She was a yellow lab and was definitely more active and alert than Kay or Flo had ever been. A few weeks after Bessie came home, she showed us just how remarkable she was. In December 1981, my sister Maureen gave birth to her third child, a daughter whom she named Erin Rose. Bessie loved the baby. Whenever Maureen came downstairs with Erin and my dog was off duty, Bessie would stay close to my infant niece. One Sunday evening in April 1982, we were all seated at the table for our weekly family dinner. Bessie was lying at my feet. Erin was in a bouncy seat that had rollers, so that she could move around the room. Without warning, Bessie bolted from my side, raced over to Erin, and knocked her little bouncy seat a few feet backward. The baby started crying. As they ran to comfort Erin, my mother and sister yelled at me to scold Bessie for scaring the baby. Then they realized what actually happened. Someone had left the door to the basement slightly ajar. It was an opening small enough that nobody noticed it. Nobody except Bessie, that is. When my dog saw how close that the baby was to getting to the door, Bessie realized that one push by Erin's bouncer would open it, sending her forward into a dangerous tumble down the stairs. Bessie used her seeing eye training to take action and to save a child's life. My dog was a hero. Almost exactly a year later, Bessie would prove her heroism once again with an act of canine bravery and sacrifice that still brings me to tears. I was in the middle of my nightly 11 p.m. routine of walking Bessie when I heard an odd sound coming from down the street. I quickly identified it as a car scraping and smashing into other cars. Union Street had a tavern at the end of our block. Occasionally, patrons would drink too much and get behind the wheel. The Jersey City Police Department usually did a great job at stopping them. Tonight, one of the drunks got through their net. My brain processed the fact that a car was speeding out of control on a direct course toward me. I froze. I wanted to react, but my body was gripped by fear. Not Bessie. She recognized the danger as soon as I did. Before I knew what was happening, my dog ran in front of me and knocked me backward, just as she had done for my niece. I was safe. Bessie suffered for her heroism. Her leash was violently ripped from my hands as the car struck her head-on. She was dragged 100 yards up the block. I sat on the ground in shock, screaming for help. My neighbors ran out of their homes to come to my aid. Unfortunately, the driver had escaped the scene and was never caught, leaving Bessie's crumbled and bloody body in the middle of Union Street. She was rushed to the emergency animal hospital, but it was too late. I held my brave and lovely partner in my arms as she breathed for the very last time. It took me a few months to return to the Seeing Eye for another dog. Several players expressed their condolences. Dave Righetti was especially kind. His career was in full bloom by then, as an heir to the great Yankee pitching legends. I told him that I thought he was next in line to throw a no-hitter, something no Yankee had done for a quarter century. He laughed at the notion. On July 4th, 1983, I was at the Seeing Eye, listening on the radio as Righetti struck out Wade Boggs of the Red Sox to complete a no-hitter. I was thrilled for him, but felt bad that I couldn't be there to congratulate him in person. When I saw him at the stadium a few weeks later, accompanied by my new dog, a male black lab named Tommy, Dave gave me a ball inscribed, "To Eddie, you predicted it." Dave Righetti, July 4th, 1983. Then he whispered, "That's for Bessie." Holy Family had an annual fundraising variety show that was languishing by the time Herb Miller came along. He was always looking for new ideas to help the school, or trying to revitalize old ones. This show would be a perfect project for us. The benefit gala had actually been started by my mentor, Jerry Malloy, in the 1950s. Jerry passed away in 1977, so it was an honor to follow in his giant footsteps. Just as I had done for the telethon a few years earlier, I reached out to celebrity friends to participate in the gala show to raise the profile. Ted Brown, a local radio legend from WNEW, presided over the show and would often arrange for singers and comedians to appear on the bill. Established names like singer Jerry Vale and up-and-coming talents like comedian Joy Behar all pitched in. Dolly and Marty Sinatra were big supporters of the school throughout their lives. They were both gone by then, but Herb thought it would be a good idea to honor them posthumously. We reached out to Frank Sinatra's representatives in California to let them know about our show and the tribute to his parents. To our amazement, we got word that old Blue Eyes himself was so touched by Holy Family's salute to his mother and father that he was going to drop by the benefit show to represent them and accept on their behalf. There were some conditions. Mr. Sinatra would not be performing, just making a short acceptance speech. He would only stay for about 30 minutes. We were not allowed to publicize his appearance at all. They were all fair requests. Herb and I were just excited that one of the biggest stars in the world would be on hand to speak to supporters of the school. I was as excited as I'd been at almost any other time in my life. I'd be meeting my musical idol. I couldn't wait to share stories with him about how kind his parents were to me. We kept the secret pretty tight. Nobody knew about our special guest. The night before the show, I got an urgent phone call from California. Sammy Davis Jr. had died. Given that he was one of Mr. Sinatra's best friends, naturally, plans had changed. Funeral arrangements were being made in Los Angeles, and there was no way Sinatra could come to New Jersey for the show. Of course, we understood. Nevertheless, our benefit show was still a big hit. We made more money for Holy Family that year than any other. Herb and I wondered if we could schedule other events, perhaps even with Scooter's help. Mr. Rizzuto was one of the greatest advocates of charities for the blind, including Holy Family. Like Russ Hodges in San Francisco, Scooter would use much of his airtime to mention them in between giving play-by-play and the score. He also donated 100% of his fees from speaking engagements and royalties from his books to the school and other worthy causes. Coupled with his long career as a broadcaster and player, this made Scooter one of the most beloved Yankees ever. The team knew what a treasure they had in Rizzuto. In 1985, they announced that Phil would receive their ultimate honor. His uniform number 10 would be retired, and a plaque featuring his likeness would be added to the wall in Monument Park, Yankee Stadium's fabled mini version of the Hall of Fame. The ceremony was set for Sunday, August 4th. Before a game against the Chicago White Sox. John Fugazi, the director of special events and promotions for the Yankees, made a very special request of me. He wanted me to be the keynote speaker for Phil Rizzuto Day at the stadium. The speech would be made during the ceremony in front of 57,000 fans and live on TV. I accepted without hesitation. This would be a chance for me to publicly thank Scooter for helping me to change my life. I wanted the world to know what a terrific guy Mr. Rizzuto was. Fugazi was giving me the perfect opportunity to do so. I was asked to put together a 2.5-minute speech describing the unique friendship Mr. Rizzuto and I had developed over 34 years. The words came easy to me. I spent months paring them down to a streamlined talk that would fit into the time limit. When I finally had it at the 150-second mark, Fugazi called me again. He realized that WPIX would be televising the event to an audience of millions, wanted to add commercial breaks. To accommodate them, I needed to cut 30 seconds from my keynote address. The solution was simple. I'd originally planned to mention each of Phil's children by name. If I just admitted that part, since they would probably be mentioned by others anyway, I could shave off the extra time. It worked. I now had a neat and concise 2-minute talk. Bob Deal was my guide that afternoon. The stadium was completely sold out. Even the press box was jam-packed. I stood on the field before the game as several Yankee sponsors and teammates presented gifts to Phil, Cora, and their kids. The New York Daily News gave him a live cow named Huckleberry. As Phil went to greet his new pet, the cow nudged him, promptly knocking him to the ground. Phil, showing the trademark humor that endeared him to his admirers, popped right back up with a huge grin on his face. 20 minutes into the ceremony, my name was called by MC Frank Messer, Phil's broadcast partner. Bob walked me up to the microphone at home plate. I took a deep breath. Home plate at Yankee Stadium is hallowed ground. This was the same spot in which Lou Gehrig made his famous Luckiest Man on the Face of the Earth speech in 1939. I was following in some huge footsteps. For a moment, I was overwhelmed by the task. After my initial nervousness disappeared, I began my 2-minute speech. I had the cadence and timing practiced to the second. I also made one big error. I hadn't factored in the feedback that comes from the public address system at cavernous Yankee Stadium. There is an actual delay of a second or two from the time you talk into the microphone until it comes out of the speakers. This causes a weird and jarring echo. Even experienced singers get thrown when they try to perform the national anthem from that spot. My timing was way off. I abandoned any hope of keeping to the allotted 2 minutes. Winging it was the best option. I had a feeling that I might be going over my time limit. Nobody was saying anything to me, so I figured it was okay. What I didn't know was that the WPIX camera crew was frantically waving at me to finish up. Unlike Howard Danzig, who realized that hand gestures wouldn't work for me on the stand, these guys had no clue as to how to signal me. I was unwittingly causing agita for the director of the broadcast. Bob Deal finally put an end to it by walking over, tapping me, and quietly saying, "They want you to finish, Ed." The added minutes didn't ruin things after all. The pregame ceremony finished on time and without a hitch. Phil was delighted and humbled by the day's tributes. He and Cora took me aside to thank me for being a big part of it. I told them that there was no way I'd ever be able to repay for all of the kindness and friendship that they'd shown to me. Public speech in his honor was the least I could do. I owed my career and so much more to the Rizzutos. I now had a regular baseball column in the Jersey Journal called As I See It, and a monthly column in the official scorecard magazine of the Yankees sold at the ballpark and on newsstands. 24-hour sports programming on cable TV and talk radio was in its infancy. They would call me as a guest for local and national TV and radio shows. I enjoyed talking baseball with hosts like Art Russ Jr., Barry Farber, Ed Randall, Bill Daugherty, Spencer Ross, Richard Neer, and Ann Liguori on stations like Sports Channel, ESPN, WOR, WABC, and WFAN. WMCA Radio, AM 570, gave me a Saturday afternoon show of my own. I co-hosted it with Howie Carpent. Howie was a local guy who knew the rules of baseball inside and out. He now serves as the official scorer for both the Yankees and Mets. During our show, Howie and I would take calls from fans, have guests like Mr. Rizzuto, Hall of Famers Richie Ashburn and Ralph Kiner, and play pre-recorded interviews. It was some of the most fun I've ever had covering the game. John Sterling also hosted a show on WMCA and would have me in to chat. He had an amazing voice and an almost encyclopedic knowledge of sports. In WMCA's overnight spot, they had an energetic kid, Chris Russo, fresh out of college. He was dubbed Mad Dog. Chris was a fellow Giants fan. He and I bonded right away. He was funny, a breath of fresh air in the sometimes stuffy sports world. I enjoyed his work and figured he'd get pretty far. Mad Dog now has his own channel on Sirius XM Radio and is one of the most famous broadcasters in the United States. John Sterling went on to become the esteemed voice of the Yankees for a whole new generation of fans. It couldn't have happened to two nicer guys. My friend Eddie Dunphy introduced me to Kevin Williams early in the 1980s. Kevin was a station manager at WOBM Radio in Toms River, New Jersey. He'd heard my interviews and hired me to cover baseball for the station, which had a large audience in the South Jersey area. I did that for almost 20 years. All-star pitcher Al Leiter, a Toms River native who came up with the Yankees and was a three-time World Series champion with the Toronto Blue Jays and Florida Marlins, once told me that he loved listening to me on WOBM when he was younger. In addition to the sports shows on traditional radio, I did work for two stations dedicated to blind listeners. One was called EIES of New Jersey. The other was In Touch Network. I would do interviews with players like I did for WOBM and WMCA, but these had a different angle. The questions I asked dealt with things that sighted people take for granted. I would encourage the players to describe what it looked like to enter Yankee Stadium for the first time or to see a play develop. Some even described their uniforms. It sounds simplistic, but many radio hosts and broadcasters overlook things like that. Michael Kay, who was the face and voice of the Yankees Yes Network, is a notable exception. He takes special care to always describe home and visiting uniforms for blind listeners. One of Kay's most famous on-air phrases is his description of the Yankees' classic home uniform. They're wearing their crisp white jerseys with an interlocking NY and pinstripes and no name on the back, of course. I'd sometimes take questions from blind listeners on In Touch. They were very incisive. I didn't lose my sight until I was 12, so I had an image in my head of what a ballpark looked like. Anyone who was born blind had no sense of this. As a result, I was asked things like, "Is the foul pole thin, like a fishing pole, or thick, like a flagpole? Is a dugout actually dug out of the dirt, or like a little room on the field? Does home plate look like a dinner plate?" I tried my best to answer them all, giving thanks to God that He was allowing me to share what I knew with other fans who couldn't actually see the game they loved. When I give banquet, corporate, and after-dinner speeches, the organizers sometimes want to leave time for questions and answers. It's at these events that I'd gotten some interesting inquiries from sighted people who are curious about what life is like for a blind person and broadcaster. Here are some of the most frequently asked. Are your other senses even stronger? Are you able to feel, taste, and hear things better than us? This is the biggest misconception about blind people. The comic book hero Daredevil has these powers, not me. The only thing that I can honestly say increased a bit after my accident was my sense of audio perception. It's what helps me to identify which direction baseballs are headed just by the crack of the bat. It also comes in handy when trying to differentiate voices. Some people say, "I'm better with faces than names." I don't have that option. I can remember others only by their voice. Bob Shepard was sitting in the Yankee dining room when he called me over to his table to solve a dilemma for him. NBC had hired two sportscasters who were identical twins, Doug and Don Gould. Try as he might, Shepard just couldn't tell them apart. He asked me over to decipher which brother was which. It wasn't that hard for me, but others were relying on their visual cues. Their voices were as different to me as a redhead would be from a brunette for sighted people. Speaking of colors, knowing the difference between them comes naturally to most sighted people. It's one of the hardest concepts to get across to the blind. There is just no way to describe colors. Think about it. If I had asked you to tell me what yellow looks like using only words, it would be impossible. I can conceive of colors because I saw what they look like, but my palette is limited to the primary ones. When a player tells me his uniform includes teal, burnt orange, or metallic purple, I'm clueless. The only baseball colors that I'm familiar with are red shandings, Vita blue, and Dallas green. Another question I get often, do you have to feel someone's face to know what they look like? This is a popular myth about blind people, perpetuated by Hollywood. You know the scene I'm referring to? Someone without sight reaches out, puts his hands all over another person's face, and then miraculously knows exactly what he looks like. Not only is that unsanitary, it's just not true. I rely on something I call mental mapping to see people. It's their voices that give me an image of their faces. My idea probably doesn't match reality, but it doesn't have to. It's unique to me. Reggie Jackson once asked me what I thought he looked like. My description made him larger than life, like a mythical hero, a la Paul Bunyan. He liked that better than the reality. On Old Timers Day one year, I asked Mickey Mantle to take a picture with me. Like Thurman, he joked about a blind person wanting a photograph. "You can't even see the photo, Eddie," Mickey said with a chuckle. "How do you know I won't be making faces at you the whole time?" I told Mantle that he looked the same way to me as he did on his rookie baseball card in 1951, before I lost my sight. I still pictured him with a full head of shining blonde hair, a chiseled body, and a 1,000-watt grin. Mickey grabbed me and shouted, "I like the way you think, kid. Let's do it." I used the mental mapping to build actual maps in my head, too. Long before everyone's car was giving them directions via GPS, I was able to get around with my own internal system. I think that my aptitude for math and simple geometry helped. I'd committed so many streets, highways, and shortcuts to memory that I could usually help my escorts get around detours or traffic. One of my guides knew that I'd memorized several shortcuts to the stadium, so he had a friend of his call me for directions. I walked him through it step by step over the phone. Later that year, I was at a Lions event when I was introduced to a member of the club from South Jersey. He said, "Your name is Ed Lucas? That's so funny. I took directions to Yankee Stadium from a guy with that name who drives his car over there all the time. Do you know him?" I laughed. "Know him? He's standing right in front of you." The guy was left speechless. It works indoors, too. There was a blackout at Yankee Stadium during a game. It only lasted for about 15 minutes. While we were waiting for the lights to come back on, one of the reporters said aloud, "This is terrible. I have to use the bathroom really bad, but it's too dark for me to see anything. I have no idea how to get from here all the way over there." Blind guy to the rescue. I didn't need lights, of course, so I spent the next few minutes helping my fellow broadcasters make their way back and forth from the press box restroom until the power returned. There's no line in the box score for bladders saved, but if there were, my name would be listed with a few of them that night. The strangest question I ever got was, "Do you hang out with guys like Ray Charles, Stevie Wonder, and Ronnie Millsap?" It's like they think that we have a little club of blind people that has secret meetings. I respect these guys for their tremendous talent and use of their gifts, but I've never actually met them. We have our blindness in common, but I'm no more connected to them than I am to people like Bruce Springsteen, Queen Latifah, and Bon Jovi, because we all happen to be from New Jersey. Jose Feliciano, the Grammy-winning blind singer of Feliz Navidad fame, was introduced to me when he sang the national anthem at Yankee Stadium. He told me that he admired my work, and I repaid the compliment. One of his escorts wondered why I didn't wear dark glasses as Feliciano, Charles, Wonder, and other blind people did. Unless it's a sunny day that calls for it, I've never worn sunglasses. This is something that I feel strongly about. It stems from seeing the beggar on the streets when I was young. He was wearing dark glasses. As with the cup and cane that he had, I always associated those glasses with helplessness. I realize that's not the case with most blind people. They wear their glasses to cover their eyes or to protect them. But I don't need them, and try hard not to get pigeonholed into other people's image of what a blind person should look and act like. Sometimes stereotypes about the blind can be used for humorous purposes. I was at a party with Bowie Kuhn when I decided to have a little fun with him. I walked over and said, with as straight a face as I could manage, "Mr. Commissioner, I believe there's a job in baseball that I'm extremely qualified for. I'd like to apply right now." Kuhn, who was with a large crowd of reporters, was puzzled. He politely replied, "What job is that, Ed?" My answer, "Umpire," brought the house down. The umpiring job wasn't offered, but lots of other opportunities were pouring in. A Japanese company had developed a new kind of baseball that was dimpled. They claimed that it would help avoid injuries to young players. I was hired by them to do endorsements in the United States and Japan. Speaking engagements were also becoming more frequent. After much inner debate, I decided to leave Meadowview County Hospital to pursue these other interests and broadcasting full-time. I established a company called No Cup or Cane to handle all of the requests for my time. Exiting Meadowview also gave me the opportunity to devote more energy to fundraising for charities dear to my heart. Herb had some excellent high-profile ideas to support the children at Holy Family. One of them was to have an auction featuring items from the Yankees and Mets. I've been visiting Shea Stadium and the Mets more often since they hired Jay Horowitz, one of the best PR men in the business. Jay treated me very well and helped get me access to some of the star players of the Mets as they began their incredible rise to championship status in the mid-1980s. I became close friends with catcher Gary Carter, pitcher Dwight Gooden, and outfielder Daryl Strawberry. When Daryl heard I was having an auction, he personally went around the clubhouse collecting autographed items from his fellow Mets superstars for me. The Sisters of St. Joseph offered their beautiful residential facility on the cliffs overlooking the Hudson River for the auction. We set a date for late August, on a Saturday evening following a Yankee day game. Scooter came to help auction some items from the Yankee old-timers. Jay Johnstone, the eccentric former player who was then a Yankee broadcaster, acted as master of ceremonies. Yankee catcher Bob Guerin showed up to represent the team and to mingle with fans at the auction. It was a smash hit. Thousands were raised for Holy Family that night. Herb was ecstatic. Even so, Mr. Rizzuto proposed a bigger, bolder idea. He wanted to have a celebrity golf tournament. This would be a massive undertaking. Celebrity tournaments were a lot of work. I told Scooter that I had no idea where to start. He assured me and Herb that we could do it. He was right. After a few bumps and a steep learning curve, we were able to build the Phil Rizzuto Celebrity Golf Classic into an annual highlight of the New Jersey fundraising calendar. Not only did we get golfers and companies from all over the state and beyond on board as supporters, celebrities flocked to be involved with Mr. Rizzuto and to spend the day hanging out with him. We had his buddies like Yogi, Mickey, and Whitey, of course, but stars from every arena also joined the fun. Meatloaf, Jerry Orbach, Dick Vitale, Mick Foley, Rod Gilbert, Phil Sims, Pat Cooper, Gary Carter, and Tony Lobianco were just a few of the luminaries who pitched in to help. Over the course of 20 years, we raised millions for Holy Family. Herb was astute enough to use the prominence of Scooter's tournament to bring even more awareness in Trenton and in Washington, D.C. to the needs of blind people in New Jersey and around the country. He did more than almost anyone else for the cause. My contribution was to talk about the tournament with the celebrities gathered at Scooter's table, gently nudging them to get involved. Phil's deep humility prevented him from actually talking about the golf classic himself. He would always call it the Eddie Lucas Tournament, even when doing on-air commercials and promotions for his own event. Chris was with me after a game one day when we ran into Donald Trump, who was uncharacteristically dressed in a Yankee jersey. I spoke to Mr. Trump for a few minutes about the golf tournament. He asked me a few questions about my career. As we were walking away, Trump grabbed Chris and said, "Are you 21 yet?" When he replied no, the Donald followed with, "When you are, take your dad to my new casino in Atlantic City. We have Braille slot machines now. He'll love them." I thanked Donald for his invitation. He ended by saying, "The only thing we don't have yet, Ed, is Braille playing cards." Little did he know, I carried just such a deck around in my bag. Don Mattingly actually challenged me to a hand of poker one night. I pulled out my trusty Braille deck. He dealt himself a royal flush and then said, "You know, Ed, I've never played with anyone who admitted to having a marked deck like yours." Dan Schlossberg, the author of The Baseball Catalog and 32 other books about the sport, is one of my closest friends. He decided in 1989 to help fulfill the promise that George Steinbrenner had made to me almost a decade before. The Yankees came close to pennants during the 1980s, winning more games than any other team, but kept missing out on the postseason. It was clear that I wouldn't be able to throw out a first pitch during a World Series at Yankee Stadium. The Giants were another matter. My father's favorite team was doing well for themselves in San Francisco. Led by slugger Will Clark, they were cruising to a playoff berth in 1989. Inspired by Chris, Dan wrote to Bob Lurie, then owner of the Giants, making the same request my son did. Mr. Lurie knew of me and of my history with the Giants. Not wanting to risk a situation like 1981 when there was no seventh game, or, heaven forbid, that the Giants would somehow miss the postseason, the owner declared September 12, 1989, Ed Lucas Day at Candlestick Park. Like Mr. Rizzuto, I was going to have my own day at the ballpark. Gene Meehl had lots of frequent flyer miles built up, so he offered them to me for the trip out to the West Coast. He would be my escort, since he had business meetings scheduled in California around that time. Herb Miller also made the trip to be with me when Gene wasn't available. Dan had an assignment in Milwaukee, so he couldn't go. He'd be with us in spirit. It was a wonderful autumn night in Northern California for a ball game. It was also my first time in San Francisco. The Giants featured my story on the scoreboard and introduced me to 60,000 fans. I was escorted to the mound. Pitcher Rick Reuschel stood next to me, encouraging me all the way. This was the moment I'd dreamed of since I was 10 years old. I could imagine and feel my dad looking down and smiling at me with pride. As I raised my arms for the windup, catcher Terry Kennedy took a few steps back. He was prepared for a soft ceremonial toss, but I'd asked some guys like Dave Righetti, Al Leiter, Goose Gossage, and Dwight Gooden to give me pointers before I left New York. My pitch moved right down the center, hitting his glove smack in the middle. Nobody clocked it, but I'm sure my pitch would have won a carnival prize or two that night. When the ceremony was over, I had to leave the field by way of the stands, since the game was about to start. As I walked up the steps to our box seats, a fan grabbed me and hugged me. I was startled. Then I listened to the person's voice. It was familiar, though I hadn't heard it in over 25 years. Barry Baum had been a classmate at Seton Hall. After graduation, he moved to San Francisco to practice dentistry. He was also a Giants season ticket holder. As he gripped me tight, Barry said, "I'm so happy that I was here to see this, Eddie. Congratulations, pal. You've led such an amazing life." I thought about Barry's comment on the 3,000-mile plane trip back home. God had indeed blessed me with an amazing life, and I continue to be grateful to him for that. There was still one thing missing from that life, a special someone to share it with. Scooter, ever the resourceful shortstop, was about to provide an assist for me there, too. Chapter 11. Bride of the Yankees. Hillside, New Jersey is a small town of 20,000 people, not far from Newark Airport. It was here that Phil and Cora Rizzuto settled in the 1940s to live and raise their family. The Rizzutos loved their town and were fiercely loyal to the businesses in the area. Everything they needed, they tried to do close to home. When they wanted to get flowers for someone, they would stop by a shop less than a mile away. There were two workers at the florist in particular whom they were fond of, an aunt and her niece. One day, Phil was talking to the aunt, Marlene Green, when he noticed that she seemed a bit down. He asked her what was wrong, and she told him that her niece, Allison, was having difficulty with her vision. This was frustrating to them both, and they didn't know what to do. Scooter knew. He said, "I have a friend, Eddie Lucas, who is blind. Maybe he can help lift her spirits. Is it okay if he calls Allison?" She agreed, and I made the call that would start me on a road to lasting joy. Allison Feifel was born prematurely, along with her twin sister, Lori. For 3 months, they were kept in an incubator. The increased oxygen caused damage to her developing retina cells. Her sister had no ill effects. Allison struggled with her vision throughout childhood and had problems in school. Unlike Jersey City, with its PS22, her town didn't offer programs for children with limited sight, so she slipped through the cracks. Despite the setbacks, Allison was a devoted sports fan and even played catcher on her high school softball team. After graduation, she went on to earn a degree in biology and education at Keene University, then followed that by finishing in the top percentile of her class in nursing school at Seton Hall. It was during a routine eye checkup while working as a nurse that Allison was diagnosed with retinal detachment. Several unsuccessful operations were performed. Despite the setbacks, Allison was a devoted sports fan and even played catcher on her high school softball team. After graduation, she went on to earn a degree in biology and education at Keene University, then followed that by finishing in the top percentile of her class in nursing at Seton Hall. It was during a routine eye checkup while working as a nurse that Allison was diagnosed with retinal detachment. Several unsuccessful operations were performed. She was then sent to Dr. Freeman in Boston, one of the best eye doctors in the world. He repaired her torn retinas by attaching buckles, but the vision loss was irreversible and permanent. She could not work as a nurse again. Allison's aunt, Marlene, whom she lived with, urged her to take the job at the florist. She could use her skills in a productive way without having to worry about a long commute to work or traveling at night. When I called, I spoke to Allison about the challenges we both faced. We knew from the first few moments that there was a strong connection between us. As soon as we hung up, we couldn't wait to speak to each other again. For 3 years, from 1988 to 1991, we continued our frequent phone calls, never once meeting in person. That might seem odd, but we were in a bit of a disadvantage. I lived in Jersey City, and she lived 30 miles south. Not much of a distance, but she might as well have lived in St. Louis, San Francisco, or Sao Paulo, for what it was worth. I couldn't just hop in my car to visit Allison, and she couldn't either. We made the mutual decision to keep our relationship confined to phone calls, because it would be too heartbreaking to meet each other, then have to endure long stretches of separation. On June 21, 1991, I decided to bend our little agreement and surprise Allison with a visit to her shop. My friend Carl Holzberg was taking me to the Yankee game that night. I asked him to make a detour. Allison was cleaning the front of the store when I walked in. She recognized me right away. I didn't have to say a word. We hugged for what seemed like 30 minutes. I stayed until she closed the shop. Carl and I got to Yankee Stadium late that night. I didn't mind at all. Our phone calls increased in regularity and intimacy, and then we were officially a couple. The very first date that we went on was to the ballpark. Allison was a big Mets fan, so I arranged for us to have 4 tickets to a game at Shea Stadium versus the Dodgers. Another couple drove us to the game, and we all sat together. Around the 6th inning, one of Allison's friends leaned over and whispered, "I think Ed really likes you." She was right. Allison was the perfect woman for me, one who cared more about Shea Stadium than Shea Madeline. I chose Los Angeles as the opponent for a reason. Allison's favorite player was my pal, Daryl Strawberry, who had collected the signatures for my auction. Daryl was now playing for the Dodgers, and I brought her to meet him after the game. He was very gracious to her, taking a photo with us and signing one of his bats to mark the occasion. A few weeks later, I took Allison to Yankee Stadium. Scooter was thrilled to see us together. Our diminutive matchmaker invited Allison to sit at his table and helped me to show her around the house that Ruth built. In 1994, Mr. Rizzuto got an interesting phone call of his own. After years of being passed over, he was told the National Baseball Hall of Fame would be including him in its class of inductees that year. Fans all over the country cheered the news of this long overdue honor. Allison and I booked a trip to Cooperstown for the July ceremony as soon as we heard. The amazing coincidence of that summer was that Leo Durocher was posthumously chosen to go into the Hall of Fame alongside Scooter. I would be there with my girlfriend to watch the two men who gave me a huge lift when I needed it receive their well-deserved rewards. Phil retired from the Yankees 2 years after that, ending a 7-decade run that he was told would be impossible for a little guy like him. My dog Tommy passed away around that time, the longest-serving seeing-eye dog I ever had. I did not return to Morristown for another seeing-eye dog. Chris and Eddie were old enough to help me get around. I wasn't commuting to Meadowview anymore, so Tommy was basically a stay-at-home dog by the end. Baseball also changed a bit in the 1990s. Clubhouses were no longer the raucous, freewheeling places that I was accustomed to. Things were more businesslike. Players still joked around, but there wasn't as much horseplay with the media. Nobody would be throwing towels or giving hot foots anymore. A new crop of Yankees came up in the 1990s. Bernie Williams, Mariano Rivera, Andy Pettit, and Jorge Posada were four of the players who helped Gene Michael and Buck Showalter build the core of a dynasty. They were all very open to the media and behaved in a classy manner that fitted the hollow uniforms they were wearing. In 1995, an overseas magazine was doing a story about my life and wanted pictures of me and Allison on the field at Yankee Stadium. They couldn't send a photographer, so we had to bring our own camera. The problem was that we had nobody to take the pictures. Allison happened to be talking about her dilemma when the Yankees rookie shortstop Derek Jeter heard her. Derek came over and said, "Would you like me to take some pictures of you, Mr. Lucas?" He then took the camera from Allison and proceeded to spend the next few minutes snapping shots. This was no ordinary Yankee rookie. The poise, grace, decency, and composure that I sensed in Derek Jeter early on was reminiscent of guys like Joe DiMaggio, Willie Mays, Stan Musial, and Thurman Munson. Like them, he had the qualities of a leader and classic exemplary role model, both on and off the field. It was quite clear that his future would be a bright one with the Yankees. In the 20 years that followed, I got to know Derek better. I discovered that we had many things in common. Though he was raised in Michigan, Derek's mother's side of the family was also made up of Irish Catholics from Jersey City. Derek's maternal grandfather, Sonny Connors, is actually a Hudson County legend. One of the biggest high school gyms in the county is named for Sonny. Derek used to come back to visit Jersey City during the summer in the 1980s when he was a boy. His grandmother loved the Yankees, and he would watch the games on TV with her. Derek grew up listening to Phil Rizzuto and told everyone that he was going to be the Yankee shortstop one day, just like Scooter had been. The part of Derek's story I identified with the most, though, was the love and dedication shown by his parents, Dorothy and Charles. Early on, they taught Derek and his younger sister, Charlie, that goals in life could be achieved, but there was a price. Nothing would happen without hard work, dedication, and respect for themselves and others. Dorothy and Charles, who has a Ph.D. in psychology, drew up contracts for the children to sign, which said in writing what was expected of them. Derek once told me that his parents always saw great potential in him, thanks to the gifts that God had blessed him with, even during the rare times when he lost sight of that himself. That sounds a lot like my own parents. Like Munson before him, Derek led his team to a two-decade, almost uninterrupted string of postseason appearances and championships. Jeter was named Yankee captain in 2003. Thanks to Derek and to the other young players who came up with him, the Yankees were once again the biggest team in sports. Their success even allowed the Yankees to replace the 85-year-old Yankee Stadium with a 21st-century streamlined version in 2009. I'm still getting used to it. The Yankees also started their own television network, called YES. I participated in many programs on Yankee history and was hired to report on the last few seasons of Old Yankee Stadium. I even won an Emmy Award for my work. Ernie Harwell, who, like Scooter, was nearing his own retirement after 60 years, saw me on one of my last trips into New York with the Tigers. He embraced me and said, "I knew you could do it, Ed. I'm glad you stuck with it." I flash back to the day in 1952 when he had me as his guest in the broadcast booth and gave me advice that I carried with me throughout my career. I was happy to share this moment with him. That same year, I was inducted into the Irish American Baseball Hall of Fame. This officially recognized branch of Cooperstown is located in Manhattan at Foley's on 33rd Street. My fellow honorees were Vin Scully, and Walter O'Malley, two Dodger legends. It meant a lot because they were not only honoring me, but my dad, my mom, and all of the Irish men and women in the Lucas and Fury families who preceded me. At that induction, a reporter said to me, "Ed, you've been pretty lucky in life. How do you feel about that?" The answer that came to mind was a quote that Father Carey had shared with our class at Seton Hall years before. It was from Seneca the Younger, a Roman theologian and friend of St. Paul. He said, way back in the first century, that luck is just hard work meeting opportunity. I've lived by that ever since. God placed people and events in my life that helped me to succeed. But if I hadn't been totally prepared mentally, emotionally, physically, and spiritually, those opportunities would have passed me right by. You have to keep yourself ready and in position to receive the blessings. As Dr. Charles Jeter also pointed out to his son, nothing comes easy. Hard work is always the biggest key to the equation. The only place success comes before work is in the dictionary. It took some hard work for Allison and me to keep our relationship going. We hit some rough patches, but we hung in there. In the early 2000s, I had a skin cancer scare. Allison was right there with me as I recovered from my operation. By this time, I was living alone in the house on Union Street. My mother had passed away in 1999. Maureen, 5 years later, and Eddie and Chris left to start their own families. Allison's aunt Marlene died the same year as my mother, so she was alone in her house too. The time was right for us to get together permanently. On Thanksgiving morning, 2005, I asked Allison to marry me. She said yes. The next question was, "Would you like to get married at home plate at Yankee Stadium?" She said yes to that too. Neither of us had any idea whether such a thing was even possible. Turns out, it wasn't. Nobody had ever been married at home plate. We began looking into other options when Rick Cerrone, the Yankees media relations director, called us. I'd known Rick for years, from the days when he ran his own national baseball magazine. He asked if we were the ones who put in the wedding request. When I said yes, he said, "I want you to call Gina Shindemi, who organizes our stadium events." I phoned her the next day. She said, "I have to meet you." I was curious why. Mr. Steinbrenner gave me strict orders never to allow anyone to get married at home plate. I was going to say no to you too, but the boss told me to say yes. I asked him why, and he said, "It's because Ed Lucas is part of our family." We decided to have a small service in a chapel on the campus at Seton Hall, where we would be married by a priest. But the main event would be in front of a large crowd in the Bronx at the stadium known worldwide as the Cathedral of Baseball. Allison and I spent the next few months planning our wedding, which was scheduled for Friday, March 10th, 2006. We invited more than 150 guests. Phil and Cora weren't feeling well enough to make it. But Mrs. Rizzuto gave Allison her fur coat to wear, just in case the March winds made the stadium too chilly. Chris wrote a letter to Steve Rushen at Sports Illustrated, telling him about my life and upcoming wedding. Rushen wrote a full-page article that appeared in the February 27th issue of the magazine. That story opened the media floodgates. Suddenly, my phone started ringing with calls from reporters asking to cover our wedding. Rick was getting the calls, too, at the Yankees spring training camp in Tampa. Once word got out that this would be the first ever wedding at home plate in Yankee Stadium, it became a newsworthy event. Rick took the pressure off of Allison and me by running all requests through the Yankee PR office. There would now be more reporters at the wedding than guests. Cerrone set up a post-wedding press conference in the Yankee media room with the Yankee banner behind us, just like the players and managers have after their games are over. All three network morning shows wanted an exclusive interview and coverage of the wedding itself. Bob Dotson of NBC's Today Show had always been one of our favorites, so we went with him. A few days before the wedding, Dotson and his crew set up an interview in Mr. Steinbrenner's private box. It was freezing. There was snow all over the Yankee Stadium field. This was shaping up to be a very chilly wedding indeed. On the morning of the wedding, we woke up to an unexpected weather forecast of sunny and 75 degrees. It was an amazing day, unseasonably warm for early March. But an even bigger surprise occurred when we arrived at the stadium. What had been snow-covered and dormant a few days before was now vibrant and fresh. Mr. Steinbrenner asked his grounds crew to make the stadium look just like it would for opening day, even though that was almost a month away. The wedding itself was just like a fairy tale. A judge from the Bronx presided. Eddie read the familiar passage about the virtues of love from Corinthians chapter 13. Chris read a poem about life and baseball written by former pitcher Jim Mudcat Grant. Irish tenor Ciarán Sheehan, who starred in The Phantom of the Opera on Broadway, sang Always, Irving Berlin's famous love song in the 1942's Pride of the Yankees. Finally, Allison and I got to say I do on the very spot where so many of our heroes had their own memorable days in the sun. As soon as the wedding was over, we were rushed to the press room for interviews. There was standing room only. It felt weird to be on this side of the interview table. Someone asked Allison why I picked Yankee Stadium for a wedding venue, and she said, because he wanted to give me the biggest diamond possible. Eddie thought ahead and brought two bats, a ball, and a glove as props for wedding photos. They brought us back out to the pristine field with a red, white, and blue bunting and the scoreboard that said, "Congratulations, Ed and Allison, on your special day." We posed with the bats over our shoulders. I held a light-colored stick, and Allison had a dark one, which contrasted nicely with my black tuxedo and her white wedding dress. The next day, several newspapers ran that photo with the headline, "Bride of the Yankees." The reception was held upstairs in the private Yankee Club. Allison and I sat in a booth shaped like a giant catcher's mitt as well-wishers came over to talk to us. The room was adorned with pictures of the Yankee players and their greatest moments. It felt just the right place to celebrate. Actress and film director Penny Marshall was there, along with producer Elliot Abbott. They had made a league of their own and were interested in learning more about my story. We were happy to have them among our guests. Toward the end of the evening, one last surprise from Mr. Steinbrenner was announced. He couldn't be there himself, so the boss sent a congratulatory note, which was read by Chris. George was returning the check that Allison and I had written to cover the cost of the wedding. He was taking care of the whole tab himself. It wasn't a small amount. He insisted that family members should not pay for the use of their own house. As he had so many times before, Mr. Steinbrenner left me in awe of his generosity. I hope George doesn't mind that I just told more than two people about it. I saw Mr. Steinbrenner for the final time at the All-Star Game in Yankee Stadium in 2008. It was the last time at the old stadium, and they were using the pregame ceremonies to honor all of the legends who played there. I happened to be in Monument Park area out by the bullpen in left center. Chris was my guide that night. Toward the end of the introductions, George was brought to the bullpen gate in the golf cart. They were going to ride him around the perimeter of the stadium to hear cheers from the fans in honor of the six championships he'd helped to deliver them. He was right next to us. When Chris told me he was there, I leaned over and said, "Thanks for everything, boss. I love you." George looked over at me. Unable to speak, he gave a thumbs up and nodded. I couldn't see this gesture, but I could feel the warmth that came my way from him. 2 years later, I was at the All-Star Game in Anaheim, California, with Chris, when we got an early morning phone call that Mr. Steinbrenner had passed away. It was a sad day, but it also made me happy that people were finally lifting his self-imposed moratorium on stories about his generosity. The boss didn't want to ruin the public image of him as a stern taskmaster, prone to firing and rehiring managers, players, and employees. He asked everyone to keep quiet about his charitable works until he was gone. The world would now know the George Steinbrenner I had known for years. Going to All-Star games and Hall of Fame inductions gave me a chance to catch up with the players I might not ordinarily get to see on a regular basis. When Goose Gossage was put in the Hall in 2008, I was in Cooperstown to cheer him on. The president of the Hall, Jeff Idelson, invited me and Chris to be his guests at the gala party the night before. Most of the living Hall of Famers were there. Chris was in the corner chatting with Reggie Jackson when both of them noted Willie Mays enter the room. Chris came to get me. We approached the Say Hey Kid. Willie was losing his sight and was moving a bit slower, but he was still as sharp as ever. He greeted me with a cheery, "Hey, Eddie, how you doing, man?" We talked about the old times at the Polo Grounds and my very first interview in 1957. I told him that I still had the photo of it that Uncle Eugene snapped. There were others waiting to talk to Mays, so I said goodbye. Before I had a chance to walk away, Willie grabbed my arm and said, "How about another picture?" With that, he and I did our best to recreate the pose from 51 years earlier. Herb Miller was with me at the All-Star Game in Boston in 1999. They introduced a special Team of the Century before the game. Fenway Park erupted in cheers for 10 minutes when Ted Williams was brought out. He was the greatest Red Sox player of them all and was taking a long overdue bow. Herb made sure that I got to see Ted before he left the park. Williams rarely appeared away from his Florida home, and I wanted to thank him for all he'd done for me. As soon as we got close, Ted snapped to attention. "There you are, Eddie. I see you over there. Where's Kay? How come you didn't bring her?" I didn't have the heart to tell Mr. Williams that Kay would have been almost 30 years old in human years at that point. He shook my hand and said hello to Herb and left with a big grin. It was a magical night. The Celebrity Golf Classic had been running smoothly for two decades. Herb and Scooter made sure that the students at Holy Family and blind children all across New Jersey and throughout the United States got as much funding as they possibly could, thanks to our tournament. Unfortunately, we suffered two major losses in rapid succession. Herb Miller died suddenly in October 2005. It was a shock. He was relatively young and in good health. Other than the stress of running the school and constantly seeking new methods of fundraising, he was a carefree guy. My heart broke for Zinnia and their children. Holy Family was never the same after Herb's death. The nuns shut the door to the building completely a few years later, and it was eventually demolished. The school that I lived in and loved was gone forever. And then Phil Rizzuto passed away in 2007. He had been in ill health for years, but it was still a crushing blow. Allison and I got to see him a few times toward the end at his assisted living facility. He was still the same old Phil. Though his voice was weaker and he was confined to his room, the spirit of the little man whose heart was as big as all of Yankee Stadium shone through. I am constantly inspired by such things as Derek Jeter's Turn 2 Foundation, Don Imus's Ranch for Children with Cancer, Curtis Granderson's Grandkids, the Michael J. Fox Foundation, the David Ortiz Fund for Children, Oprah Winfrey's Leadership Foundation, Danny and Marlo Thomas's St. Jude's Children's Hospital, and other examples of celebrities leveraging their fame to give back to their communities, helping thousands of worthy causes in the process. The Yankees have also continued George's philanthropic endeavors. Thanks to Media Relations Director Jason Zillow and George's children, Jennifer, Hank, Jessica, and Hal, the team instituted an annual event called Hope Week. Not only do the Yankees donate to these charities, they highlight them for an entire week at the ballpark and on television, encouraging fans to be supporters. It's an organization using the power of its brand for good. To emulate all of these inspiring examples, Allison and I began the Ed Lucas Foundation in 2012. It is meant to provide support and guidance to blind and disabled people and the organizations that assist and serve them throughout the United States and the world. Bob Deal passed away in 2010, but his fellow lion, Herb Bodensick, was a man cut from the same cloth. He had lots of experience setting up foundations and gave me excellent guidance. Several other people, like Tim Courtney, Rich Cutter, and Joe DiDio, and old friends like Gene and Karen Meal, and the five Dunphy siblings, Eileen, Ann, Eddie, Mary, and Regina, were instrumental, along with Mr. Bodensick, in helping me and Allison get the foundation up and running. One of the events that directly led to the Ed Lucas Foundation was Strikeouts for Scholarships, a partnership created by David Nussbaum between WCBS Radio, Seton Hall, and the New York Yankees. For three seasons, beginning in 2008, $10 was donated for each strikeout thrown by a Yankee to a special fund set up to help disabled students at Seton Hall. The public was encouraged to match donations. It was very successful, but limited to one school. Allison and I wanted to expand it to benefit students from any college, as well as any disabled children, adults, or senior citizens facing their own uphill battles. Many people wondered what would happen to the golf tournament after Phil's death and the closing of the school. Gene Michael, who was largely responsible for putting together the Yankee team that won all those World Series championships in the late 1990s, stepped in to fill the large void left by Scooter. He wasn't replacing Mr. Rizzuto, just carrying on his legacy. Thanks to Gene, the Golf Classic, renamed in his honor, is still going strong. In the years to come, I hope to expand the reach and scope of the Ed Lucas Foundation, following the pattern set by Derek and the others. More and more people each day are left facing a life of blindness and disability due to injury, disease, or aging. We would like to be a beacon for them. If you'd like to learn more about what we do at the Ed Lucas Foundation, I invite you to visit us at www.edlucasbook.com. There's even a link there where I will send you a bunch of gifts to help you get started on making a difference in your own community. I have been blessed many times over, and it has humbled me. Whenever there were moments that I could have thrown in the towel and completely given up, God placed people in my life to lift me up and to keep me moving forward. You can be that person for someone, too. Several of the people I encountered in my journey just happened to be Hall of Famers. It's a special title given to those who excel in a certain area. That seems like an unreachable goal for many, one reserved for icons and immortals. Nothing could be further from the truth. Each and every one of you has the opportunity to be a Hall of Famer in the eyes of someone in your life, in a quiet and meaningful way. It's easy to do. My obstacle just happens to be blindness. But everyone has his or her own mountain to climb, whether it's physical, psychological, financial, emotional, or otherwise. We all face battles at several points in our lives. If you just take the time to recognize and empathize with those who are going through rough waters, reach out to them and lend them support in your own way. You will be a Hall of Famer to them. My passion just happens to be baseball. But if you follow your own passion and live it to the fullest, you will quickly discover the rewards that come from it. Doing that helped me to carve out a successful career in sports, despite my limitations. But it just as easily could have been law, education, science, entertainment, or dozens of other vocations if that's where my heart took me. It was more about the drive than the journey. By following your passion and working hard at it, you are enriching not only your own life, but those of others who are watching, especially your children and family members. Once they see you proving that anything is possible if you set your mind to it, no matter what the naysayers claim, you will be a Hall of Famer to them. My faith just happens to be Roman Catholic Christianity. But if you look to a higher power, no matter what your denomination or creed, it can help bring you comfort in times of crisis. This has always worked for me and my family, putting into action the lessons from the good book we heard from the pulpit. When you shift your focus from yourself onto others, treating them as you'd like to be treated, the central tenet of almost every religion, your life will improve in the process. It seems like a contradiction, but I've discovered that the more I do for others, the happier my own life becomes. If you take time out from your busy day to perform an act of kindness for a friend, or even a complete stranger, you will be a Hall of Famer to them. My service organization just happens to be the Lions International, but I encourage you to join a club in your local area. It doesn't matter whether it's the Lions, Kiwanis, Rotary, B'nai B'rith, the Knights of Columbus, the Elks, or other similar clubs. They are all outstanding organizations that gather like-minded people to give back to their communities while offering opportunities for personal growth and networking. By joining a local service club and becoming an active volunteer and helping those in your community who need it the most, you will be a Hall of Famer to them. So many wonderful things have happened to me in my life that I feel it's my duty to give back, to comfort others, and to help them realize their dreams. I encourage you to do the same. We were all on a journey home. It's how you treat others along the path that makes the difference. Always be there for other people. Be the shoulder to cry on, the ears to listen sympathetically, the eyes to recognize suffering, and the arms to hold someone tight when that person is hurting. Do all of these things, and I promise you that when you round the bases for the final time, you will be welcomed home at the end of the game with love by God, who will surely include your name on the list of life's Hall of Famers.